Cannabis Corner. My name is Lucas Barfield. I'm a local Tacoma cannabis activist, researcher, and educator. And I am joined by my co-host, Uncle Dig, who is a veteran medical cannabis grower and podcaster out of Oregon. How you doing today, Uncle Dig?
I'm doing great. How about you, Lucas?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good, man. I just wanted to talk to you real quick before we get going on the show. How did your harvest come out? Last we heard, you were doing your garden update, and you were getting ready to do that. Did that come out all okay for you?
Yeah. It came out pretty good. My per plant yields weren't exactly where I wanted them, but because I grew so many plants, it really didn't matter. I've got almost what I need to have cannabis for a year. We'll see. And I'm also going to be doing some indoor stuff coming up in December after I get done raising these chickens, which you may be hearing in the background. They live in my studio right now, and they've gotten quite loud.
Yeah, little bitties there in the background. I grew up with chickens, so it's kind of great to hear them. But, yeah, I'll just let you keep those there. And we won't be bringing them over here to Tacoma or any chickens here on the Cannabis Corner studio property. But hope you're enjoying the chickens. You were saying they help you out with your cannabis growing and keep the bugs down and everything.
Well, yeah, recently the last batch of chickens, one of them started eating the cannabis leaves off my plants instead of just picking bugs off of them. So I had to keep the chickens locked up in the front yard during a better part of the cannabis season. But now that the cannabis plants are down, I don't have any plants right now. They've got their run of the yard and they're eating all kinds of bugs, especially they help keep down the earwigs and the slugs and snails.
All right. Yeah, the chickens are they're good animals, sometimes a little handful, but definitely grew up with chickens, had a lot of experience with those, and I'm a vegan now, so I have the total respect for the chickens. Don't put them on my plate or anything, but yeah, they're interesting birds. I got around, not to kind of divert a little bit, but I got around some chickens one time in Birmingham, Alabama, that kind of lived in the trees and everything. And that was real interesting to see. People let them roost in their trees at night.
Oh, yeah.
Keeping them in sheds and everything. That was real
cool. We have a little bantam chicken that's about a third the size of a regular chicken. And if we let it get away on us, it'll perch at a tree sometimes at night. It doesn't do it anymore. It goes to the coop now. But they like to be up a little higher because they can fly a little higher. And for our audience, these are egg chickens. These are not meat chickens. So I don't generally slaughter my birds.
Yeah, right on. Nice to hear that, Uncle Dig. And I just wanted to mention real quick, Dig, we will be having on Peter Aspig later to talk to us about CBD and hemp. Peter's the CEO of Sweet Earth Farms, so looking forward to having him on the show. Before we get going on our news, I just want to give a quick shout-out to Session Goods down in San Francisco. They are a women-owned pipe and bong company, and they have a new series out called their Designer Series. Just wanted to give them a shout-out. They actually sent me a pipe and a bong, Dig, to do a write-up for my other gig over at Ganjapreneurs, and I'm going to be writing that up, and so keep a lookout for that over at Ganjapreneurs with some pictures and everything, but just give them a shout out real quick on the radio show, sessiongoods.com. I looked at the pipe. It's a very interesting pipe shaped like a cone. It is a white pipe and a really nice, sleek designer design. So check it out if you can, sessiongoods.com. And we're going to jump right into our news now. And our first news story today is out of Pakistan. And we've talked a little bit about Pakistan and Afghanistan a couple times because of Dig's experience over there in Afghanistan as a army soldier. But today we're going to talk about Pakistan, and they are actually kind of trying to come on to the cannabis scene and start growing cannabis there in four places in Pakistan. Dig, what do you think of that?
I think that's pretty cool. There's already a thriving underground, both in Pakistan and Afghanistan, especially in the tribal areas in northern Pakistan and in southern Afghanistan, think Kandahar province and stuff. There's a lot of cultivation going on there even before this legalization initiative start. So what this will enable the world to have access to more heirloom genetics and land rakes genetics that we previously might not have had access to, at least not at the level the market really wants. There's a few really dedicated seed banks that have been making landrace genetics from that part of the world available now for the past, like, you know, 2 or 3 years, the ones that I'm aware of. There's been a few, you know, expeditions that go there, collect seeds, mm-hmm. they come out. But then once those seeds are sold, they're gone. And that part of the world can be dangerous to travel in if you're not a local. So we've had limited access to some of those genetics. And I know more and more people are getting turned on to the different regions of cultivation around the foothills of Hindu Kush, going down through southern Afghanistan, Pakistan, and into India, and how special that cannabis really is and how diverse.
Yeah, and it kind of looks to me like they're looking around at countries like Colombia, who have been known as like narco states in the past. And Colombia, as we've talked about, they're exporting medical cannabis. And they say they have cannabis oil experiments going on in government labs and everything. So it looks to me like they're trying to capture some of the revenue and, like you were saying, share some of the great cannabis coming out of that region with the world. And it kind of looks to me like they're gearing up to do some exports. But it's great to hear that big countries like this are starting to liberalize their cannabis policies. And the United States is getting close, but it would be great if Pakistan would come on board, and then we can kind of start unrolling this drug war, and we can do it around the world and not just here in the United States.
Well, and I think before we move on from Pakistan and their reform as a topic, I think it's important to remember that as larger nuclear powers, like big, serious countries, Pakistan is a nuclear power. They are part of many international agreements. And what this does is this legitimizes cannabis in a way, especially if they export, right or wrong, a little bit more than Colombia. So the more of these big countries start looking into this, I think the better off the movement will be in the short term.
And so that's going to move us on to our next story, and that is out of Montana, a little closer to home. And as everybody remembers, Montana legalized cannabis back in 2020, and then they passed a bill, HB 701, that set up adult use system there, but they had a little surprise regulation pop up. And what that is, it's saying that dispensaries can no longer sell cannabidiol or CBD or hemp itself. They can't sell any products derived from the hemp plant, which, as we know, Dig, hemp plant is a cannabis plant that is just special because they've bred it to just have 0.3% THC or less.
Well, and that historically, that's not always been the delineation, right? So historically, hemp and cannabis were of course separated because hemp was not as psychoactive, but also the structure of the hemp plant made it more appropriate for hemp fiber production and stuff, rather as a drug cultivar. Now, legally in the United States, the structure of the plant doesn't matter. What matters is, like you said, the percentage of CBD to THC.
And so the regulators and everybody were looking through the law, starting to create their system, and all of a sudden they realized, oh, well, the dispensaries can't do this anymore. So what they're saying is, can't have hemp in the dispensaries, you can't have CBD from hemp in the dispensaries, nothing from hemp in the dispensaries. And it didn't mention Delta 8, but this has to be, they have to do like a wholesale. So if a dispensary has hemp-derived CBD right now, they got to sell it all by January 1st. And this is in total contradiction or in the opposite direction Washington is going. Next week, we've talked about this before, but this is coming up. Everybody want to look this up. November 15th in Washington State, the Senate is going to start talking about hemp-derived CBD and Delta 8 and hemp-derived products coming into the regulated cannabis market rather than keeping it out. So it's kind of interesting how the two states are going in opposite directions with this.
Yeah, I understand that people feel the need to regulate cannabis. I think that this attempt to separate the plants into two separate markets is dumb, and it's a direct result of our stupid puritanical belief that any form of inebriation is somehow sinful in America. And I think we need to kind of get away from that because it's causing undue headaches for these dispensary owners. It's confusing for the consumer. And the delineation at this point is an artificial line in the sand, which is making it more difficult for everyone to get along and go along. It's dumb.
Yeah, not to mention the drug war is racist and all that that they've been doing for all these years. And this is really just a continuation. And it's just like all these different things are coming to head, white supremacy, racism, and the drug war. They're all coming to head all at the same time, and it's just giving regulators, and I think this is why the federal legalization is not going forward, because there's just this patchwork of laws all over the country. Like you said, the puritanical, we got the racism, we got all the different things, the misunderstanding about cannabis. It's all coming to a head, and it's really causing all the regulators a really big headache, and it's stifling the industry.
Well, and what we've seen in Washington specifically, and I think you're going to see this in other legalization. I mean, Washington is a great example of how regulation has made people less safe by selectively enforcing certain laws, letting people divert willingly, making the system easier to navigate for some than others. Washington has been an education in how not to do things for the rest of the country. And I think part of that is their need to regulate things that don't necessarily need to be regulated.
That's going to get us right into our next story, which is a story out of Leafly. And Leafly, if you don't know, is like a cannabis strain site where you can go and sometimes order stuff online, or you can check out your favorite strain, the terpenes and everything. But Leafly has come out with a new report saying that cannabis is the fifth largest crop cultivated in the United States, Dig.
And I read this article, and what's interesting is the delineation they make is they're only talking about legal cannabis here. So the top five crops are corn at $61 billion for 2020, soybeans, $46 billion, followed by closely by hay at $17.3 billion, then wheat at $9.3 billion, and then cannabis comes in at number five at $6.2 billion. That's only legal cannabis.
Yeah.
Now, there's no way to really know how much illegally cultivated cannabis is out there, right? And then you've got other, and then you've got home grow, which no one's talking about. But just crop cannabis that is cultivated outside the legal system is probably equal or greater to that, which would mean that cannabis, if you really think about it, is actually closer to wheat at number four and maybe even surpass it. Because you would think that if the legal crop is one size, then the illegal crop has to be big, at least as big, if not bigger. So that would put legal cannabis at 12 point something billion dollars annually, probably more. So that means that cannabis is really one of the fourth largest crops in America when you really think about it.
Yeah, and it certainly is more, because one of the caveats to the study was, and they used the methodology, the same methodology, and you go over an article and read it over at ganjapreneurs.com, but and some other places, and leafly.com, they have it up there, but they use the same methodology that the USDA uses to make all those other calculations. And like you said, the underground market is certainly there, but one of the things is they only looked at the 11 states where medical marijuana or medical cannabis is sold and recreational cannabis is sold together. So they only looked at 11 states, but 18 states are out there doing recreational cannabis right now. So you're absolutely right. Cannabis is probably way up there and maybe even the fourth or third slot. And it was fascinating to see that one of the conclusions they had is kind of like, what the heck? We're the fifth largest cultivation crop in the United States, but we don't have banking. We don't have insurance. You know, we can get into our It's a Bust segment. I mean, the fifth largest crop in the United States right now, Dig, if you and I both were to go to our hometown and walk into the courthouse with just a quarter ounce, 7 grams, that's such a small amount, and waving around in the air, we're getting locked up in jail, even though this is the fifth largest crop in the country.
Yes, you will be. It is crazy. I may get a ticket. The place I'm from in Texas, Harris County, recently decriminalized possession of less than an ounce.
Oh, so wow.
I know, it surprised me.
Congratulations. That's really great to hear.
Yeah. I mean, it's a step in the right direction. Harris County is the northern part of Houston, as well as some smaller towns, those towns that I came from. And, you know, it's still up to the officer how he's going to enforce the law. That's what I want to tell everybody. So don't go running around Texas with a half ounce of weed thinking you're good, because that's one part of a very big state. But I will say that even in Texas, there has been progress. Now, it remains to be seen whether there'll be any additional progress. You see that I don't want to get off on voting, but we're having some problems with voting rights in this country, and I don't know what that's going to do for cannabis reform.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, it's just interesting to go and check this report out, and that was just one of the big takeaways from the report was, hey, let's get the stuff legalized federally. Let's fix all these laws so we can actually bring farmers in, and farmers can start making real money and start really bringing them out of the shadows and doing all this correctly into the American system. So,
and this also lets us know that we have more power than we think. If we're 12, like a $6 or $12 billion industry, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
We need to stop accepting
absolutely
that the police harass us and yes are violent to us. We have a right to cultivate plants that are safe on our personal property. And a farmer's land where he's doing his business is also usually his personal property. You ought to let a farmer grow what he wants to grow. And when someone comes in and is violent, we need to stop accepting cannabis raids. And we need to stop, you know, licking the boot that's on our neck.
Yeah, and it's real fascinating that here in Washington, we bring in so much cannabis tax money. We're way, way up there at the top as far as what is brought into the state. And yet, we have no power. We can't ever get any bills passed. They won't fix the medical cannabis system. Yet, they go around bragging how great the cannabis industry here is in the state. So, I'm with you. We need to really start flexing our muscles a little bit as far as consumers go, as far as our legislators go. Say, hey, look here, legislators. This is the fifth largest crop in the country. You know, they looked at all the states. Some of the states, it's the largest crop in the country. In Alaska, I don't know what the second largest is, but it's double whatever the second largest one is. So a lot of these states, cannabis is leading the pack as far as bringing in money. And guess what? Like I was just saying, the regulators ignore it. In some cases, I think here in Washington, they don't even track it. It's kind of like a slush fund that just goes into the general fund.
So, stop voting for people who don't do what you want them to do. Even if that means sitting it out or voting for a third party Yahoo once. Stop voting for Democrats or Republicans if they run their mouth negatively on cannabis.
Yeah,
stop it.
Yeah, and I totally agree. Please, we have to start showing up, and I'm really here on this in Washington a lot to non-cannabis people who don't use cannabis, who aren't medical cannabis patients. You know, cannabis needs the regular population to say, hey, we're tired of this too, because it's so many people. I mean, you have, look at the sales numbers. There are so many people using cannabis out there, maybe just once a week, maybe just once a month, but nevertheless, it is widespread in our society, and it is time that we stop throwing people in jail all over the country for this. Just to illustrate our point about why cannabis is treated bad, yet it's such a good thing, we go on to our last story in our news segment, which was out of Florida, and that is talking about a survey they did of 157 patients in mostly Southwest Florida, but they did go all over the state. They did 157 patients in the survey, and 65% of those patients said that they had come off of one pharma, not come off of, they had reduced at least one pharmaceutical prescription since they went on that medical cannabis. And that is really good news, not for the pharmaceutical industry, but just for society in general, because some of those pharmaceuticals got pretty bad side effects, Dick.
Yeah, they do. And I think it's important for people to remember that the great thing about cannabis and its entourage effect, sometimes not only can it be, you know, a painkiller, it can be, it can take the place of, I'm not a doctor, okay? I'm not giving you medical advice. Talk to your doctor. It has been shown that sometimes it can do the same thing for someone as anxiety and medications. And a lot of times once people find that they can do something with cannabis, they find that cannabis is safer for long-term usage than the med they were on before. And so when you find a safer med should be cheaper, it's not always cheaper, but it should be cheaper. And that's partially due to Florida doesn't allow home grow. So I understand that for quality medicine in Florida, it's very, very expensive for quality cannabis in Florida on the medical program. And we can talk about that in a moment, but cannabis, a lot of times, whether it's smoked or eaten, is its LD50 rate is so high that there's no real world risk for a deadly overdose. So it's literally safer short term than just about any other med out there when you really think about it. you need less aspirin than cannabis to kill you, much less.
Yeah, and they said one of the takeaways from this study was they said that the after they took away outliers and they took away non-responses, 110 patients said the average amount they spent on cannabis every month was $300. And, you know, that's kind of high for a person on disability and a person not working. So one of the takeaways they were saying was, you know, we do have to lower the price. Although I've spoke with some people I know who have medical cannabis in Florida, you know, they have some pretty good prices compared to Washington. I was kind of shocked. You know, a good quarter starts at maybe $25 and it goes all
the way up.
That's not bad. All the way up, you know, 40, 50, 60. But check it out, Dig. All the cannabis in Florida, it's tested for pesticides. It's tested for mold. They probably don't cheat on their THC numbers like they do in other states we know of. So,
like just about every legal state.
Yeah, so they might be. But, you know, it's just interesting how this is another state that kind of came on late that seems to be trying to do cannabis well. But let's try to get those prices down for patients in Florida. And check out that story over at GunEntrepreneurs.com for more information on that Florida study. And so now we're going to get on to the guest for this week, and that is Peter Aspig. And Peter is the CEO of Sweet Earth Farms, and he's here today to talk to us about CBD. And we are back here on the Cannabis Corner. My name is Lucas Barfield, and we are back this week with an interview. And unfortunately, Dig is not able to join us this week on the interview. He is out sick. He will be back next episode. And today for our interview, we are joined by Peter Aspig, the CEO of Sweet Earth Farms. And he is going to talk to us today about CBD and some things going on in the hemp industry. How are you doing today, Peter?
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So let's jump right into it. So tell us a little bit about how you got into the CBD and hemp industry.
Well, first of all, I'm based in Vancouver, Canada, but our farm is in Oregon. And so the way I got involved is so we're a listed company. We trade on the TSX and the OTC, and so we had a group of farmers who were basically you know, obviously they're very passionate about their growing and you know, breeding and the whole process on the farm, and I was an independent director of the company. And so what, you know, over the course of a year, one day, and we had several meetings and, you know, they've got a great team down there. And so I basically said to them, I said, you know, we've got an opportunity here because the difference between essentially the cannabis market and the hemp market is that the cannabis market, you started out with some very major big players like, you know, Canopy, Tilray, and Aurora. Mm-hmm. And they raised, you know, billions of dollars of capital, and they became the industry. And then what happened is you saw the cannabis industry kind of evolve, and you saw, just like you did in the beer industry, where suddenly microbreweries start popping up. And so then you had, you know, all these niche cannabis players who you know, weren't like the Miller beers or the Buds, but they had a very specific type of market, a very specific type of strain, and focused on their niche. And that's basically how the cannabis industry evolved. With the hemp industry, it was quite different because you started off with a bunch of microbreweries. So you had all these growers, you had all these, you know, people making creams and body rubs in their basements and selling them online. But what you really lacked is a leader. And so I basically, in one of our meetings, I said to the team, you know, like we really have an opportunity here to grab this and to become, you know, through various affiliates or various relationships, we can actually become one of the top five leaders, you know, in the global hemp scene. And so at that time they said, well, okay, well, you know, we'll take care of the farm. We would really love your guidance as to, you know, the guidance of the corporate side. So that's how I became the CEO. But the team has been down there and they've been, you know, they were involved in the medical marijuana sector for 15, 20 years. So they were pretty experienced before they got into the hemp. You know, they weren't potato farmers who went to hemp. They went from medical cannabis into the hemp sector.
Yeah, it's a pretty common story here in the Northwest where people started out in the medical cannabis sector and then kind of some went into the more regulated high THC side, and then some also went off into the hemp side of things. So you're the CEO there at Sweet Earth Farms. So tell us some of the challenges that you have faced. You said you're in Vancouver, and then the farm is in Oregon. So what are some of the challenges you faced sort of doing hemp business between the two countries?
It's a good question. I would say there's the only problem or obstacle that I would say is significant is that we have a lot of people in Canada who were like, oh, we'd love to buy your products. And, because they read the reviews and the awards we've received. And we still weren't able to ship the products, even though, you can have a muscle rub and, even though it contains CBD, you're not able to export or, transport CBD across the Canadian-U.S. border. So that's been, I would certainly say, the biggest problem. We've just kind of solved that. We're starting in November, we'll be able to sell our products in Canada because we are able now to produce. So we produce all our creams, and then we have a lab in Canada that will be able to blend our CBD, which has been tested as well, and then we'll be able to sell into the Canadian market. But that's really been the only difficulty because, the group that we have, in Oregon and in California, they're very good at what they do. And so, they're much better on the agricultural side than, any value that I can add, but I can, certainly help with on the corporate level of getting into the right places, getting into the right markets and helping the company that way.
Yeah, and I was looking at your webpage there at Sweet Earth Farms, and it was some interesting stuff there I wanted to talk about real quick. You said you're more on the corporate side, but maybe you comment on some of the agricultural things I found fascinating. So tell us a little bit about the process that the farm uses as far as the greenhouses and getting the hemp plants out to field. And it sounds like some kind of innovations that you guys have going on there.
Yeah. So first I would say that one of the goals of our company is essentially the farm to shelf platform, right? So, and now that in itself is not new. I think we were one of the first, but you have several people who, okay, we're growing and then we're going to create products. I think what we did that is unique, that I would certainly consider us to be one of the leaders, is that we really based a lot of our innovation, a lot of our, right from the growing all the way to the product development, all the way to the manufacturing of the products, we really based it on science. So sorry to talk too much, but now I'll start with the farm side. So, on the farm side is we wanted to develop a strain of CBD, of hemp that is high in CBD and as low as possible in THC, because especially if there are markets in Europe that you can export to, but you have to have below 0.3% THC, as we know. So, most plants are above that. So you basically take away the opportunities that you could have from exporting to the EU. So we started out, with our breeding team, and they created a seed. And this is before we really started selling our CBD strain and our biomass. It took about a year and a half of breeding, and then from there the seeds go into our greenhouse. In the greenhouse, what we do is we then take the plants and we put them into, we've got four greenhouses that are specific, and they're very, very large greenhouses. And we then plant the seedlings in there, and then we create an environment that is induces a perfect environment for them to grow robustly when they're young. And in that environment, we don't spray. There's a mist that kind of circulates around the air. There is sunlight, and I believe we have sunlight that goes for 14 hours a day, and then we go dark, and then we wait until the seedlings are 6 to 8 weeks, and then we take all those seeds and then we move them into the fields. So that's the farming side. And you know what's important about our farm, and it's not just the method, but you have to understand, in Applegate, Oregon, it's like, you know, it's like the Napa Valley of hemp. So our farm is located right along a river. It's almost like on a peninsula of a river. So we've got natural water. So the water that we use for our irrigation comes naturally from a very, very clean river that you could drink out of. The soil in Applegate is a very, very, you know, healthy and, or, you know, soil that is very rich in nutrients. And the location is warmer than most of the areas in Oregon, because it gets just through the way the climate is there. It's a microclimate that is milder than most areas in Oregon. So you've got not just the right techniques, but you also have the right location. And then from there, I would say another thing that we've done that is really unique is that, you know, when people say, okay, CBD isolate. So when we look at our creams and our products, right? And people say, yeah, they, you know, this has 20% or 10% CBD. That is very deceiving, because, you know, CBD in itself is not the same, because we look at a smaller micro grind, which is a smaller MEU. So the size of our grains of our isolate are smaller than most of our peers. And, you know, when you look at the markets where CBD is traded, and you can see it trades like $800 a pound, or $700, $600, or $1,000. Well, that's typically 150 micro size of a molecule. And we use a much smaller molecule because it's able to penetrate your skin better.
Yeah, I've heard of these new CBD products that have the smaller micro molecule size. And that is really interesting. And it's sort of the new thing coming out where it's where they're able to use the chemistry in labs to really manipulate the natural CBD and change it into a better absorbing product. So tell us some of the advantages of using some of those smaller micro molecule sizes.
Well, I would say that, and this is I think that this is a problem that the overall industry had with the CBD product industry, is that, you know, a lot of people were using creams and saying, you know, they don't work. And what you have, what people have to understand is that, you know, your skin and your pores. So, you know, beneath your skin, you have a membrane, and then your pores are, you know, have a certain size. And your pores and your skin membranes are there to protect anything from entering your skin. I mean, that's why they're there. Otherwise, you know, if it's raining and you walk outside, water would absorb into your blood system, right? So you have skin membranes that are there to protect creams or anything from entering into your deeper skin membranes. And so what you do is, like, if you take a 150 mu grind and you have a cream that has 20% CBD, your skin may actually only be absorbing 2% of that. So you're basically wasting 18% of that CBD. Whereas if you grind it down, you can get up to 20 to 40% penetration. So if you think of something that is 20% CBD with 2%, 2%, you know, bioavailability, you're getting, you know, an impact of 4. Whereas if you have 10%, CBD, but you're getting a 40% penetration, you're getting, it's not only penetrating deeper, not only penetrating your skin, but it's actually able to penetrate to your muscles. So, you know, you may not get any muscle effect from a larger molecular size CBD in a muscle rub, but you'll get quite a positive impact or benefit or bioavailability from something that is utilizing small molecular sizes.
We talk a lot on the corner about how the United States is getting left behind when it comes to exporting cannabis and CBD. Talk to us a little bit about Canadian CBD exports and what's going on with that these days.
So the biggest reason why is because there's, you know, Canada has entered into a trade agreement with EU that is much more open. So that's, you know, that doesn't have anything to do necessarily with the type of product, but, you know, there are several agreements between Canada and the EU that under the previous administration, they pulled out of those agreements. So that's something that is a political a policy-driven exclusion and not necessarily a quality-driven exclusion. And as a matter of fact, I would say that one of the, you know, let's put it this way, the Europeans want American CBD because it is the best quality in the world. So, I mean, if you look at CBD grades in the EU, I mean, they're running 3-5%. And if you look in the United States, they're getting, you know, up to 15% in the flowers, right? So it's very clear that the American strains of hemp are superior, but they're just not able to get exported into the EU. But that's a policy-driven reason.
Yeah, and I've seen some projections about the CBD EU market, and it is expected to just grow and big margins coming up. So what are some of the things coming up in CBD technology and hemp that you might be expecting in like the next 5 years that we might not know about?
I think that, so I'm always, when I look at how the CBD, so you read all these reports on, okay, CBD sector is going to grow, you know, to 24 billion by this year, or, you know, like 27 billion I saw by 2024. And you know, I take that with a grain of salt, because I think what is happening as well in the market, and I think it's a needed adjustment or evolution of the way CBD is, and you can look at, and I'll give an example of the cannabis sector, because people often compare them, but you know, the cannabis sector has become much more regulated. And it's also the companies that are actively participating and succeeding are putting out really good products. So so you're seeing a sector that has evolved. Now, if you look at the CBD sector, the claims that people are making, or the claims that companies are making, you know, this is good for rheumatism, this is good for muscle pain, this is good for, you know, skin care, skin revitalization, you know, salves. And so you have all these claims made by these companies, but they're actually not based on science. Hmm. So I think what I really envision, and this is what our real focus is in within Sweet Earth, is that, you know, products, like if you look at the FDA, and I sit on a board of an oncology company, and, you know, the FDA clearly regulates the medical industry. Yeah. And now you have CBD companies who are putting out these products, and they're saying this is good for rheumatism. And yes, CBD is good for rheumatism, but the companies that are putting the products out have no data on what the bioavailability or the efficacy of their products are. So I think what I see happening in going forward is that the FDA will say, you know what, if you're making these claims, you need to provide us some data that your product actually works that way. And it's going to be a little bit, it's going to become more regulated, where companies that are saying, here's a muscle rub, where people are going to have to be able to show if their product actually has any benefit to relieving muscle pain. And you know, I think that's going to, it's going to have a twofold effect. One is that it's going to kind of get rid of the companies that are making claims that aren't backed by science. It'll benefit companies like Sweet Earth that are really you know, that is the core of our you know, that's our core credo, is that, you know, every claim that we make or when we're putting on products, I mean, it needs to be based off of science. And then the second, you know, impact of that is that the market, so this is now the customers, are going to start feeling more comfortable, because now they're able to actually look at a product. And right now, people are just comparing prices because they think they're equal. But what they're going to be able to do is they're going to be able to compare a product based not on price, but based on the efficacy of what that company is manufacturing. And that is going to happen in the next 5 years. And I think it should happen and needs to happen.
Yeah, some really good information in there. So I just wanted to have you clarify, just to help our audience out real quick, because I'm a cannabis activist here in Tacoma and do a lot of writing on cannabis. And I get this question all the time, and I see it all the time. If someone is looking for a CBD product and they're looking at the label, what are some things they should look for so that they know that their product is actually going to work for them?
You know, that, you know, I bring up a sad reality, is that when you look at the label, you can't tell, because the way you will have to, what's happening. And I think we're, because we're going to start doing that on our labels, is we're going to start putting down the micro size of the molecules, because it all comes down to the molecular size. But, you know, we've done tests where, you know, people are just, you know, and we've all taken science classes, right? So, you know, you can take CBD and you can just start, you know, this isn't like making a cake, right? So you're not baking something and you're hoping for a good taste. What you're doing is you're creating a product that you hope has efficacy, or that you hope actually does what is the reason why you're buying the product.
Yeah.
And so we do, you know, we're doing research right now on, you know, some people are saying, okay, well, yeah, this is a nice lavender cream, and it's got CBD in it. Well, you know, do you even know if the lavender binds with the CBD to neutralize the actual effect of the CBD? Because now you've created a larger molecule. Mm. So these are the type of tests that we do. Like, you know, we need to understand which scents, or, you know, what ingredients go with the creams or the products or the rubs that you're actually acquiring. And so I think that you're going to see more and more, like, you know, labeling of molecular size, like CBD molecular size. And that's going to, I think that's going to be a start where people are going to be able to understand that there's greater efficacy. And then the other is, you know, you need to read the reviews of like, you know, for example, I know like our product, we were featured in Hemp Magazine last year in 2020 as the only muscle rub and hydration cream in Hemp Magazine, because in their product test that they felt that we had, you know, the best value. You know, it was the same with Shark's Discoveries and being featured on the Kathy Ireland show and the article in Women's World. I mean, you know, I guess right now you have to understand what the consumers or, you know, the reviews of the products are. And then at probably in 6 months down the road, you'll start looking for molecular size in some of these products. And that's going to be able to tell you.
Yeah, that's a fascinating point about the CBD and the lavender. I had not thought of that. When you add the CBD isolate back to a product and it contains the lavender terpene, which is linalool, it just kind of combined back like it was before it came out of the plant, because they're organic molecules together. So that's a fascinating point I had not thought of before. And
you know, we're testing a whole bunch. We're testing various things. So we're going to put out we're going to publish a paper on this. And you know, as Sweet Earth publishes these papers, it's good for the industry in general. Like, we're not, you know, I think that the players that are research focused will benefit from one another, because the more the companies learn, the better products they can make, and the happier the consumers are, and then the consumers feel more comfortable. So it's kind of, you know, it's a secular evolution of what the CB industry needs.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Peter, for being on our show today. And I wanted to just have you get out of here by telling us your website and where people can find out more about Sweet Earth Farms if they want to go out and see your products and read more about them out there online.
Sure. Well, we have three websites. One is called Sweet Earth CBD Skincare. So Sweet Earth is easy to understand. Sweet Earth Skincare. If you Google Sweet Earth Skincare, you'll be able to look at our skincare products, and you can see how, you know, advanced, and you'll be able to see the awards. We also have Sweet Earth Pets, and that's we have dog treats, and we got into that because we were at the MJ Biz Show, and that's in 2019, and we received an award for top hemp product at the MJ Biz conference, and then we were approached by Dog Snack, and they said, "Look, we have your values. We'd love you to work with us to create a dog treat." And so we did that, and then we also have a Sweet Earth Smooth, which is a pre-rolled hemp cigarette. It's not a cigarette. We don't do it, but it's a pre-rolled hemp, and what it is it's you know, the bioavailability of inhaling CBD is quite significant because you're getting 90% efficacy, and we use it as a product to help people who want to quit smoking, and it's very, very popular for customers in their 40s up, which kind of surprised us. We thought it would be more recreational, like for the younger audience, but it's very, very popular for, you know, people 40s and older, and that can be found on sweetearthsmooth.com.
All right, very interesting there, and I get a lot of questions about cannabis and pets, so be sure to go check that out over there at their website if you want more information about the CBD and your dog. And again, I want to thank you so much, Peter, for being on the show, and go over and check out his website and learn more about Sweet Earth Farms. All right, I'd like to thank Peter for being on the show, and now we're going to get on to our final segment of the show, and that is our It's a Bust segment. Now, I have to be honest with the audience, Dig and I have been kicking back and forth that we were perhaps going to set this segment to the side and maybe try something a little different, until we saw that report that we reported on last show that says 350,000 Americans are still getting arrested for cannabis every year. And I think that we should still highlight that, and we should still speak about that. So it is, especially because all the headlines you always see are the Green Rush making millions, buy cannabis stock. But like we were just talking about earlier in the show, the war on cannabis is still going on. And this week, it's a bus segment takes us to Tennessee. And what a case we have. A felon who's 33 years old. I forgot his name, Dig. You can tell us his name in a minute. He's 33 years old. He's in Lawrence County. He got busted with 25 pounds, which is a lot of cannabis, probably growing it himself. And he was Amish. And the really disturbing part of this story for me was if they took the guy's guns, a whole collection of guns, and they propped it up by the cannabis with a little small wad of $100 bills to show how big a drug dealer this guy was. And you can tell that they're really using this guns and the cannabis and the money together to really strike fear in the people there in Lawrence County, and for the police to show, hey, look at us, we do need to be here kind of thing. Tell us about the guns in the picture, Doug. Dig, you were telling me he's got like a muzzle loader in there and all kind of stuff. It's just ridiculous what they did to this poor guy.
So now for everyone, this is in Tennessee. So gun ownership is common, and it's common for guns to be inherited over generations. So it's not uncommon for a young man to have 15 firearms on his homestead.
No, it's not.
this young man has 10 long arms and 2 pistols. There's only 2 modern long arms among the long arms. There's a Mossberg style shotgun, and there's an AR-15, which is also one of the most common rifles to own in this country.
It is.
The other rifles he has are of varied antiquity. He's got a single shot 410, which is the smallest shotgun shell you can get. It's a good like squirrel hunting gun. He's got a couple of lever action rifles like you'd see cowboys use. He's got another single shot shotgun and a single shot muzzle loading Kentucky rifle, which they've propped up next to this, and another couple of old shotguns. And when I say old shotguns, I mean shotguns that you might expect to find in a barn. On top of that, he has 2 single action revolvers, one of which is a black powder revolver, the other of which appears to be an old Colt style cartridge revolver.
Wow.
This is not a dangerous drug dealer. This is a farmer.
Yeah. And that's what you're telling me in his picture. He looks like just old country boy, Amish guy. And the police got wind he was growing cannabis. He had 25 pounds, and they came in there and swooped in. And it's just a really travesty, because the guy with that 25 pounds and those guns, he is probably getting 10 to 20 years in prison, Dig.
Oh, I mean, yeah, and maybe he's gonna lose his land.
He's going to lose his land.
The cops are going to take his land. They're going to resell it. They're going to make money off the land. They're going to make money off of selling his guns. They're going to make money off of selling his car. And they're going to keep him in a cage because this enterprising young man happened to be selling a little bit of weed. And that's just not okay.
Yeah. Sad situation there in Tennessee. So we do need to keep an eye on the drug war and keep talking about it. Remember, in Washington State, 1.1 ounces is illegal. Now, I don't know what a cop would do to you if they found you with that, but you still can get busted in Washington and Oregon and California and any of these other legal states if you have the wrong kind of cannabis, if you have the wrong amount of cannabis. They still can harass you. They still can mess with you. So we really need to stay on this and end the drug war, finally.
Let's make cannabis truly legal, like a tomato.
And so that is going to get us out of here. I wanted to mention, if you would like to contact the show, you can send over an email to info@radiotacoma.org and put in the subject Cannabis Corner if you want to ask us any questions. Also, I'm going to be putting a podcast feed on this soon, so keep an eye out for that. We're going to be getting up to our 40th episode soon. We're going to be making some changes and adding some things to the show. We're really looking forward to that. How can the show get in touch with you, Dig?
Yeah, if the audience wants to get in touch with me, they can contact me via my email at UncleDig4@gmail.com. Or if they want to follow me on Instagram, I do some funny stuff on there. I also do some garden pictures and garden videos when I am cultivating. And they can follow me on Instagram at UncleDig. And if they want to hear my podcast that I do, it's a little more adult-themed than this one, they can follow me at the Bagseed Chronicles. You can find that wherever podcasts are.
This is Cannabis Corner, hosted by Lucas Barfield. If you would like to get in contact with your host, he is on Twitter at MJIsMedicine. Your musical selection is The Happy Monster by Chubby Jackson and his orchestra, recorded on 78 in 1947. You can find this music and much more at The Great 78 Project, an archive of historical music recordings at great78.archive.org. You are listening to 101.9 KTAH, Radio Tacoma.